This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So, welcome to the Mini Medical School. My name is Robert Nussbaum. This is Julianne Wojak, who's my partner, and we're going to be doing this as a tag team. We've been working on the genetics of cardiovascular disease for a number of years now. At UCSF, and so I think it's quite fitting that we do this as a tag team. I'm going to go first, and then Julianne is going to be the cleanup hitter. Okay? Thanks. All right. So, what are we going to do tonight? We're going to describe some inherited heart diseases and explain relevant genetic principles to try to understand how we approach these conditions. We're going to illustrate the importance of family history and describe some of the benefits and limitations of genetic testing. We'd like to demonstrate the utility of genetic counseling in the setting of cardiovascular care, and we will examine some of the common psychosocial issues and some of the ethical considerations that come up during the care of patients with inherited heart disease. Heart disease comes in many forms. We have heart disease in which there is a disease of the heart muscle, such as a dilated cardiomyopathy, where you can see instead of the normal heart, you have thinning of the wall. You can have anatomical or congenital abnormalities of the heart, where instead of a nice complete wall here between the two atria, there may be a hole. You can have coarctation of the aorta, where the aorta, instead of being this normal arch, has a narrowing here, which blocks the flow. You can have a tetralogy of Fallot, which is an unusual congenital heart condition. And you can also have electrical systems of the heart defects, where instead of the normal, very highly organized flow of electrical activity that allows the heart to beat with great coordination, you can have some discoordination, which can lead to extra beats and, in fact, to very dangerous or even lethal heart rhythms. Cardiovascular disease is really one of the leading causes of death. This is males and females, blue and red or pink. Here's heart disease, which is in the United States is causing 300,000 deaths per year. Now, what are the types of heart conditions? And in particular, I want to stress the difference between acquired or non-genetic and genetic. So, cardiomyopathies. These would be heart muscle problems. You can have acquired cardiomyopathies due to various toxins, such as excessive alcohol use. But we also have genetic causes of cardiomyopathy, where there's a defect in one of the genes that makes a heart muscle protein, and therefore the heart muscle does not react correctly and properly and can undergo disease changes. You can have arrhythmias. We know that you can get acquired arrhythmias from, for example, electrolyte imbalances of various kinds, or from certain kinds of drugs can induce heart rhythms. But we also have genetic forms of arrhythmia, such as the long QT syndrome, which we'll be talking about in a minute, where there's a defect in the gates or channels that allow ions like potassium or sodium to flow in and out of heart muscle cells. You can have congenital heart defects. These are developmental, occur in the womb, where the plumbing just isn't hooked up quite right. Or we can have aneurysms or dissections, enlargement, or even tearing of an artery wall, and valve problems. And there we have lots of genetic disorders. One of the primary ones, Marfan syndrome, that we know and can look for. And then, of course, there's sudden cardiac death and sudden unexplained death, and we're now just in the process, and UCSF is actually one of the major areas, one of the major places in the country where we are exploring what are the genetic contributions to sudden death. This is being done in collaboration with the medical examiners, and Julianne is deeply involved in that research project. And then finally, of course, one of the major causes, coronary artery disease, where we know that lifestyle issues, diet, lipid intake can play a major role, but we also know that there are genetic disorders which can contribute to having elevated cholesterol in the blood and therefore coronary artery disease. And in fact, coronary disease is one of the perfect examples of why we should not think about genetic or non-genetic. In every one of these cases, there are both genetic and non-genetic factors which can work together to produce a disease. Now, the prevalence of cardiovascular genetic disorders, this is familial hypercholesterolemia, which is one of the most common forms that's a genetic cause for elevated blood cholesterols. Here's hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and this is number per 100,000. So we're talking about 250 per 100,000 or 200 per 100,000 for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The other disorders are less common, and just for comparison's sake, we have two disorders here that you've probably heard of, cystic fibrosis and multiple sclerosis, showing that they are much less common than hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or familial lipid disorders, but slightly more common than some of the other hereditary heart conditions. Now, diagnosing heart conditions, of course, as you know, there's a lot of tools we have to identify what is called the phenotype. And phenotype means the clinical appearance, the presentation of the person. And it is in contrast to what we call the genotype, which is the genetic makeup of a person. So with echocardiogram, we can look for abnormalities in heart wall motion and in valve motion. Lots and lots of information can be obtained from echocardiogram. Of course, the electrical activity can be looked at with ECG, electrocardiogram. We can put on an electrocardiogram that takes it, electrocardiogram for a long period of time, for days or even month, Holter monitor. And there's invasive testing of various kinds, electrophysiology tests where they may pass a wire, pass a catheter into the heart, angiography where we take pictures, or even a cardiac biopsy. But in here, in the area of diagnosing inherited heart conditions, in addition to these phenotypic characterizations, we also have genetic testing, which is to find out what are the genetic contributions and what's the genetic variation that's occurring. Now, let's talk about some of the genetic disorders. So, for example, one of the ones that we see a lot of here, and that's because UCSF, starting with Dr. Mel Scheinman, and now with a very large and sophisticated group of people who focus on electrical rhythms in the heart, the so-called electrophysiology group. What are the signs of an inherited arrhythmia, an inherited defect in the normal electrical conduction and coordination of the heart rhythm? So, personal history, unexplained fainting or cardiac symptoms, family history. Multiple family members who have the same type of arrhythmia, particularly if it occurs at a young age. Arrhythmia just means an abnormal heart rhythm, a heart rhythm that's not the normal standard kind of rhythm. Fainting or palpitations without explanation, and unfortunately, sudden unexplained death, including sudden infant death syndrome, but also, for example, death that occurs unexplained during swimming. What seems to have been a perfectly healthy 19-year-old who knew very well how to swim suddenly drowns for no explanation at all. Sometimes we can have a presentation of sudden unexplained death, which presents as a single vehicle, motor vehicle accident, where there's no explanation. You know, this person was not 3 o'clock in the morning. This is not somebody who had either alcohol or drugs on board. They didn't fall asleep at the wheel. There was nothing that caused this accident, and we think that perhaps this person may have had a sudden arrhythmia, loss of consciousness, loss of control of the vehicle. Now, cardiomyopathies, which means disease of heart muscle, they present usually somewhat differently. With shortness of breath, especially with exertion, you can have swelling or fatigue or dizziness, but you can also get fainting and irregular heartbeat, because at the same time that you have an abnormality in heart muscle, that often also produces secondarily an abnormality in heart rhythm. So arrhythmia is often seen in the setting of a patient with a heart muscle problem. And family history, multiple family members with the same type of cardiomyopathy at a young age, heart failure, the need for a heart transplant, and also, unfortunately, sudden death. What are the signs of inherited blood vessel or vascular disease? Enlargement or aneurysms of the aorta or other arteries, which is often asymptomatic. Patients are unaware until they get imaged that they have one of these. If the enlargement is part of a more generalized, what we call a syndrome, where there's a more generalized connective tissue problem that affects not just the walls of the blood vessels, but also the musculoskeletal system, we may see other things, such as the facial appearance or the abnormalities or differences in the skeleton, skin, some vision abnormalities. So there are other things that one can look for. And family history, family members with aneurysms and or syndromic features. And once again, sudden death can occur if you have a sudden dissection or rupture of a blood vessel because of its dilated form makes the walls of the blood vessel weak, and the person can suddenly bleed into their cavity, into the chest or into the abdomen because they've ruptured a blood vessel. Okay. So what sorts of treatment? Sometimes just close follow-up. Watching, for example, someone who has an aortic aneurysm that has not enlarged to the point where it's life-threatening, you may just watch it over time, give this person some medication, but see if the aneurysm is enlarging. Lifestyle modifications. It may be important, for example, for someone who has a dilated aorta, is not the person who should be going and pumping iron and increasing their intrathoracic pressure a lot by doing, 200-pound bench presses. This is not a good idea if you have a thoracic aneurysm. Medications of various kinds, highly specific for the particular problem. Is it an antiarrhythmic drug? If so, there are some that are better for some conditions and others that are better for others. Procedures and interventions of various kinds, including putting in an implantable defibrillator, which watches the heart rhythm and will shock the heart back into a normal rhythm automatically if an abnormal rhythm occurs. Sometimes you need to do surgery. If the aneurysm is large enough, we will send the patient for cardiothoracic surgery where they can take the dilated and weak-walled blood vessel, cut that segment out, and replace it with a synthetic graft. And then finally, it sometimes occurs that if the heart muscle completely fails because of a cardiomyopathy and it cannot be sustained and the person cannot have a reasonable quality of life, we think about heart transplantation to replace that organ. Now, what's the prognosis? In other words, what's the future for people who have hereditary heart disease of various kinds? It's variable. It depends a lot on what is the particular disorder? How severe is it when you make the diagnosis? Do patients comply with recommendations? And how well do they respond to various therapy? Now, early effective treatment for most patients can live a normal, long, and healthy life, and sudden death is preventable with treatment. One of the big major, I have two clinics. I have one clinic where I see patients with heart disease, and I have another clinic where I see patients with hereditary cancers. And there's just a very big difference in the group of patients because for the cancer patients, the cancers tend to be slow, and there's all kinds of treatment that can be done. It can be a devastating disease, but the idea that can be feeling perfectly fine and be at risk for sudden death is just not part of that patient population. And that imposes a certain level of a psychological burden and psychological issue, which Julianne will talk to you about later, that really permeates this entire field of the prevention of heart disease using genetics as a tool. And I'll show you later how important it is to be able to use genetics as a tool. So if we're talking about genetics, we need an introduction to genetics. So, as you know, genetics is the study of the inheritance of various traits. It governs everything that happens from the moment that an egg is fertilized to when that baby is born to when that baby becomes a teenager. They do become teenagers. And then adults and all the way into adulthood for the entire life of that person. And that information is all encoded in a special set of molecules inside the nucleus of the cell called DNA. And the DNA is wrapped up in little bundles And this is the famous double helix that you've all heard about, but it's wrapped up in bundles inside little bodies inside the nucleus called chromosomes. And when the DNA is a molecule, but it's also information source. And I tend to think of DNA and trying to compare a DNA to the English language. Okay, so we can think of the DNA. Let's think of DNA in the English language. You spell information in English with 26 letters. In the DNA language, you spell with 4 letters. A, C, G, and T. In English, we have words. And those words can be one letter in length and can be 25 letters in length, all variable. In the DNA language, every word is only 3 letters. It's only 3 letters, excuse me. And if you string these words together into a sentence, that's what I think of as a gene. So a gene is an instruction. It's a sentence that tells the body, oh, how to make this particular protein, let's say one of the heart muscle proteins. So you have a sentence that says, oh, this is precisely how you build a protein that's going to do a certain job in the heart. Now, you can get gene mutations. And what they are is basically misspellings. So, for example, here's 2 words. Words in the DNA language are called codons, but they're just words, AGT. And here, instead of CGA, which is the normal sequence, there's been a single change. That C has been changed to an A. Now, you can imagine sometimes if you change a single letter, for example, the word gray, G-R-A-Y, and you change it to G-R-E-Y, you haven't changed the meaning. So it's sometimes the case that you can change the spelling and it has no effect on the information content of that word or of the sentence. On the other hand, if you were to change G-R-A-Y to G-R-A-B, you've now really changed the meaning of that word, and depending on what sentence it occurs in, could really be quite disruptive to the meaning of that sentence. So that's one kind of change that we call a mutation. There are other changes, such as an insertion, where in front of the CGA, there's an extra T has been put in place, or a deletion, where we've actually lost the C. So instead of AGT-CGA, we've got AT-CGA. So we've lost this G right here. It's missing. And what that happens then, because the codons are all 3 bases, is it frame shifts things. And so that the body starts to read the DNA information out of frame, and the words are completely garbled. It's basically gibberish. And this completely disrupts the meaning of that sentence. So you can see there's lots of ways. And where do these mutations occur? Well, you have to remember that every time a cell divides, it has to copy 6 billion letters. That's how much DNA we have in our nucleus. And it does a remarkably good job. But every time a cell divides, it introduces about 10 mistakes. Most of those mistakes occur in parts of the DNA that, as far as we know, don't do anything. But if one of these mistakes happens to occur in a codon inside a gene and disrupts some of the information, then we have a problem. How big are genes? Well, the codon part of your DNA is about 2% of all your DNA. So 98% of your DNA is not spelling instructions. It's doing something else, most of which we don't know. Some of which we do, but most we don't know. And there's a very famous story that people said, oh, only 2% of your DNA is genes, is codons. The other 98% just must be garbage. And Sidney Brenner, who's a very famous molecular biologist, said, no, it's not garbage, it's junk. Well, what's the difference between garbage and junk? Garbage you throw out. Junk is the stuff you put in your attic or your basement because you might need it someday. And Mother Nature is keeping 98% of the DNA around because it's being used in some way, perhaps being used over evolutionary time in a way that we don't understand, as a way of putting together new genes and making new genetic information all the time. Okay. So this is a picture of chromosomes, which are the little bodies inside the nucleus. And this is what they look like just before the cell divides. And the chromosomes come as 23 pairs of chromosomes. And every pair, and these are organized by size. So chromosome number 1, 2, 3, etc. And there's a pair of chromosome 1s and a pair of chromosome 2s. Well, the reason there's a pair is because you get one member of this pair from your father in the sperm, and you get one member of the pair in the egg from the mother. So you have 46 chromosomes consisting of 23 pairs. 23 of them, one of each chromosome, comes from the mother, and the other of that pair comes from the father. So you're 23 plus 23, they come together, that makes the 46. Okay? Is that clear? The only, and all 22 out of these 23 pairs are the same in men and women, but one pair is different. In men, this pair, which are called the sex chromosomes, are different. There's an X, and then there's a little chromosome there called the Y, and it's the Y that confers maleness. If you have a Y, then most of the time you're male. There are some exceptions to that, but that's the situation. Whereas if you're a female, you generally have two X's. Okay? So let's now talk about the chromosomes and inheritance. So here's our 46 chromosomes, and we're only going to show one of the 23 pairs right there. When this individual, when these cells go into the gonads, into the testis or the ovary, and undergo the specialized development of eggs or sperm, at the one of the last steps that occurs in that development is that this pair of chromosomes separate, so that only one member of each pair goes into an egg or a sperm. And so, for example, this is a sperm. His tail is there, but it's in white, so it's hard to see. But when this sperm fertilizes this egg, which has one member of this pair, you then get back the pair again. So the question you have to ask yourself, the key question is, if you have two chromosomes in this pair and only one of them goes into the sperm, well, which one goes in? Is it the one that this person originally got from his father and the one that this they got? No, it's random. It's like flipping a coin, heads or tails. It's a 50-50 chance that that chromosome is going to go into the sperm and a 50-50 chance that that one will go into the sperm, and same for the egg. So if you have a mutation on one of these chromosomes, that means then there's a 50-50 chance that the chromosome carrying the mutation will end up in an egg or a sperm, and a 50-50 chance that the chromosome carrying the normal copy of the gene will end up in a sperm. Okay? All right. So that then explains what we call autosomal dominant inheritance. And so here we have an example. Here's a man, and he has two chromosomes, one of which is in black because that's the one that actually carries a mutation. And his spouse has two normal chromosomes in white. And depending on whether the black chromosome gets put into a sperm or the white one, you can see that there's a 50-50 chance that he'll either have a child who carries the mutant chromosome or the abnormal one, or a child who carries the normal one. And it's independent of sex. It doesn't matter whether the child's a girl or a boy. It doesn't matter. So that's what we call autosomal, that it's not linked to the sex of the child. And dominant means all you need is one abnormal copy of the gene. It's enough to cause a disease. The normal copy doesn't correct it. It doesn't protect. So what that means is that the mutation is, in essence, is dominating over the copy that has the normal copy of the gene. Okay? So, next, how do families come to a geneticist's attention? Usually because a cardiologist suspects a heritable condition and refers. The cardiologist takes a family history. And so here's an example. The horizontal line here is, this is a little bit cute. We usually use squares and circles, squares for men and circles for women, but we're using little hearts here, okay? So this horizontal line here means that they're a couple, and they've had three children. And so looking at this family, here's the individual who went to see the cardiologist, and he takes or she takes a family history and says, oh, you have a certain condition. You have, let's say, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And by gum, so did your mom. Maybe there's a familial cardiomyopathy going on here. I'm going to refer this patient to genetics. The person who first brings the family to the attention of genetics, there's a name for that. We call that person the proband. It's a technical term, but we use it a lot, and I'm going to use it later, and Julianne's going to use it later, so I wanted to introduce you to it. It's the affected person in the family who brings the family to the attention of the geneticist. That's called the proband. So what are the common questions? So this individual says, the cardiologist says, you know what, I think you better go talk to the geneticist. So he walks into the geneticist's office, sees me or sees Julianne. What are the questions? What are the common questions? What's my risk? Who else is at risk? Is there any way to treat or prevent the condition? Does everyone with a familial mutation get the condition? Will everyone with a mutation have abnormal cardiac testing? Will this affect my lifestyle? Genetic heart disease is treatable. Sudden death is preventable with the right medical care. But what I want to stress here is when we're thinking about genetics in the setting of prevention of heart disease, we are thinking about families. We're thinking about an individual proband who brings a family to the attention of medical care, and then it's everyone else in the family for whom genetic counseling, genetic testing, and prevention now becomes available. What is the role of genetic testing? We can use it to make a diagnosis, to identify the underlying cause of the condition, to help define risk, determine the optimal treatment, which family members are at risk by extending the genetic testing beyond just the proband, and to guide individual surveillance recommendations. So here's the role of genetic testing for the proband with this arrow here. To confirm the diagnosis, we can also provide some psychological benefit. We've had many patients say, you know, we've been around to different doctors and they thought maybe it's this, maybe it's that. You do genetic testing, you actually confirm what it is, and you tell the patient, here it is in black and white, and you can put the test result down in front of them, and there's a certain sense of, okay, now we know what's going on, now I know what it is I'm going to have to deal with. So just being able to put a good name on it can be very important. To determine a diagnosis, prognosis, and treatment, for example, for long QT syndrome, Marfan syndrome, and for sudden cardiac death, it will unexpectedly change a diagnosis and management. There are certain forms of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy which turn out to be metabolic disorders, which need to be treated completely differently from the usual run-of-the-mill hypertrophic cardiomyopathies. And sometimes genetic testing will have no impact at all on the diagnosis, prognosis, or treatment. We may just end up with, yes, this is what you have, but in fact, it's not going to change anything that we would have done anyway without the genetic testing. For the proband, for the rest of the family, is another issue. So, role of genetic testing in the proband, there's a value of genetic testing for the proband, but it's different for different conditions. So depending on the condition, you may have different value of doing the testing. What are the types of genetic testing? You can confirm a genetic change that's already known to be present in the family. This would be a single site test. It's basically saying, oh, word on the second line of page 15 of chapter 3, there's a misspelling in this person's brother or sister. Let's see if that same misspelling is present in you. So you go to that one place and see if it's there. You can search for a genetic change in a set of genes known to be associated with a particular disorder. This is what we call a panel, where panels can be of varying sizes, from a few dozen up to even 100 different genes. And that's because there are some hereditary cardiac conditions where there are many different genetic changes which can all cause the same apparent phenotype. And so just by examining the patient, you don't know which gene is involved. So you have to check many of them. And that's used when you're trying to find a genetic change in the first person affected in the family. And there are some situations where we'll search all 20,000 genes for a genetic change that could be responsible for a particular disorder. This is called the whole exome. And the exome is the 2% of the DNA that contains coding stuff for specific information. And this is used when we're trying to discover a new gene in which a change could cause a disease. This is often done as part of a research project, but not always. Now, what's the outcome of genetic testing? There are three possible outcomes whenever you do a genetic test. You find a disease causing what we call a pathogenic mutation. You find no change in the gene or genes that would explain the condition, which would be a negative result. But we also can find the change, but we don't know if it's disease-causing or not, a variant of uncertain significance, or VUS. Why? Because there's no such thing as a normal DNA. There are 7 billion different DNA sequences for every person on the planet. The only two people on the planet who have the same DNA sequence are identical twins. So you can find differences between people. In fact, between you and me, if we did our full DNA sequence, we would find between 3 and 4 million differences out of the 6 billion bases in our DNA. Between different ethnic groups, the differences are even greater. And so we may find a change, which could just be a difference that's present in one ethnic group and not in another, but is of no pathological significance, or could actually be disease-causing, but we just don't know it because it hasn't been seen before and it hasn't been confirmed to be disease-causing. So I just wanted to give you a heads up. I always say this when I talk to people. I say, when we do a genetic test, it's not like saying, oh, you're anemic or you're not anemic, or you have a high cholesterol or you have a normal cholesterol. There's actually three outcomes: disease-causing, no disease-causing, variant of uncertain significance, we don't know what it means. Now, without genetic testing, we don't know which family members are at risk for genetic heart disease, and ongoing surveillance would be recommended for all family members. We actually can't connect the dots. So, maybe symptoms, and they could maybe be diagnosed with a genetic heart condition, but we don't know what to tell him about the risk to his children, the risk to his sister, etc. With genetic testing, we can determine which family members are at increased risk and which are not by doing genetic testing. So this individual has symptoms and diagnosis and a positive genetic test result, which can then be used through single site testing. So, for example, this person, we might have done a panel to figure out which gene is involved. But once that's done, we would do a single-site test in his children to see which one had inherited the genetic alteration but may not have developed a heart condition and would need follow-up, whereas this individual did not inherit it and therefore would not need ongoing surveillance. So the role of genetic testing for at-risk relatives, for diagnosis, for prediction. If it's negative, you can reassure people. If it's positive, there's a whole variety of things we do, all the way up to implantable defibrillators. With that, I'm going to stop. That's my portion of this, and turn it over to my colleague.
Excellent. I will take this over now and talk a little bit more about what genetic counseling is and how we evaluate patients and families and what is the type of information that we share with them and the approach. So genetic counseling is something that's been around for a while, though many people are unfamiliar with the term. Genetic counselors work in a variety of different areas of medicine, most commonly in prenatal genetics and reproductive, advising couples about potential risks based on their family history and on for birth defects and things like that. In the cardiology arena, genetic counseling is actually quite new, and there are few genetic counselors around the country specializing in cardiovascular genetics because we really didn't understand too much about these conditions until relatively recently. So I feel very fortunate to be working in this area. So what we do is it's a communication. Genetic counseling is a communication process where we help help families and patients and families with inherited disease, in this specific example, inherited heart diseases. And we teach them a little bit about their condition from a genetic standpoint. Their cardiologists and electrophysiologists teach them all about what their condition means from their standpoint, but we talk about the family as being our patient. So discuss what the condition is, the basic genetics of the condition, what the risks might be, and who in the family may be at risk. We also talk about different screening recommendations so that we can prevent those risks or do our best to mitigate them. We discuss the role of genetic testing, which Dr. Nussbaum has illustrated quite nicely, and we identify specific family members and how each family member might benefit from genetic testing depending on their individualized circumstances. When patients elect to proceed with genetic testing, we handle all the logistics around that, some of the typical questions around insurance coverage and costs and things like that, to the complex questions of interpreting the genetic test results and then communicating those back to the patient and the family. We also spend a lot of time discussing the implications of these results, not only for the patient themselves, but for their family members. And often these implications are very, very, very different. You guys all know your own families. And in most of the families that I work with, the relationships are very diverse. Some family members are very close with one another, and some family members are somewhat estranged. And so when we identify a genetic cause of a condition that can affect other family members, sometimes this can involve a lot of complex and difficult communication or conversations within family members. So we do our best to help facilitate that, with the end goal of being that anybody in the family who's potentially at risk is notified of that risk, educated on what that means for them, and knows how to get help and how to be evaluated. So we provide a lot of written communication for patients to be able to share with families to facilitate that. Dr. Nussbaum alluded to the psychological impact of inherited cardiac disease, and as you mentioned, or as you probably saw and may be impacted by, sudden death is an event that is perpetually on the mind of individuals in any of these conditions. It's a common thread with all of them. It's something that doesn't get kind of talked about in routine conversation all that much. So it typically is something that can feel very isolating. It can feel very confusing, invoke a lot of fear, understandably, for patients as well as their family members. So there's a lot of psychological support that we provide to patients, and a lot of education and education about resources that are available to them. People seek genetic counseling at different times. There are some kind of typical times that they will be evaluated. If there's a new diagnosis in the family, if there's a relative who's been found to have a mutation in a gene, then that often provokes an evaluation of the entire family at that point. A typical time is when planning a family. You know, a couple gets together, and the potential mother has a history of heart disease, the father has a history of cancer, and so they want to talk with someone about those risks. Really, the answer of when to seek genetic counseling is whenever you have any questions about any potential risk in your family. I think we have a tendency to only get referrals for genetic counseling if there's a diagnosis of a known inherited disease or a positive genetic test result. But the education process, even if you find out that your family history conveys a fairly low risk to you, that can be very beneficial. So if you have questions, I encourage you to ask your doctors about it. Genetic testing and genetic evaluation have a number of limitations and complexities, many of which Dr. Nussbaum has gone over with you. All of these conditions, while we understand the genetic basis to a certain extent, we don't fully understand the genetic basis of any of them. So it's not unusual for a family to present, and it's clear they have a genetic form of, say, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but we fail to identify the specific gene mutation that's causing it. That does not mean it's not genetic. It's still genetic. It's just our genetic testing isn't good enough to find their mutation. And so it requires a lot of communication so that patients really understand that, no, their family members are still at risk. We just don't have a genetic test result that we can use to guide management at this point. Dr. Nussbaum alluded to inconclusive genetic test results or variants of unknown significance. These are very challenging. It's hard enough to answer the question of what does this mean for the given patient who has a diagnosis, but then what does it mean for their family members who may not have a diagnosis? We do spend a lot of time and do everything we possibly can to try to get more information so that we can reclassify these appropriately, and that can very often involve testing other family members. Sometimes, no matter what we do, we're left with more questions than answers, unfortunately. Whenever we are concerned that there could be an increased risk for family members, whenever we're concerned that the individual who's presenting the proband has a genetic predisposition to developing that condition, then we err on the side of caution and recommend that family members be evaluated by cardiology. This is because all of these conditions can be extremely variable, and even if we don't, family members don't have clear symptoms or abnormalities, they still could have or develop the condition later on. So we want to treat the families very, very cautiously until we have definitive information that would suggest they're not at risk. As with every part of medicine, I think the key to furthering our knowledge and understanding is research. And certainly at UCSF, this is something that I think most of us share, regardless of our medical discipline. Our knowledge in genetics is moving so quickly. And I've been doing this for a while, not quite as long as Dr. Nussbaum, but we've seen tremendous changes in just a very short amount of time and anticipate many, many more changes to come. Many patients ask very logical questions about, well, is any of this covered by insurance? This seems really kind of cutting edge and new. And certainly it is actually well covered by insurance, especially commercial insurance. Most commercial insurance covers genetic counseling, also covering genetic testing for inherited cardiac diseases. And my patients really who have commercial insurance rarely have any difficulties and rarely have significant costs for the recommendations that we make. We do still have some limitations. So patients who have Medicare and Medi-Cal don't enjoy those same benefits. And that's mainly reflected because this is a newer area of medicine, and the guidelines from Medicare and Medi-Cal have not really been updated with this at the same pace as those with commercial insurance. But we're certainly working to make some changes in that regard. Many patients, especially historically, have asked about potential discrimination based on genetic information. So patients worry that, well, if I know I have a mutation, maybe my insurance company will drop me or I'll be treated unfairly. This was a worry that I think in doing this for a while was much stronger in kind of the last 5 years. It's become less of a concern, and patients have fewer questions about it, particularly because there's more and more laws that have been passed to protect us. And also there's been a lot of changes with regard to the Affordable Care Act and really eliminating pre-existing conditions. So right now, from a medical insurance standpoint, we feel like patients are very, very well protected. Genetic testing is just being implemented in almost every area of medicine more and more, and we're not seeing adverse effects from medical insurance standpoint. There are still some limitations with other types of insurance, like life insurance and long-term care and disability, et cetera. In California, we have some legislation that protects us in those capacities, but that's not necessarily federal. So these are all things that we actually talk to patients about when they're making decisions on when is the appropriate time for them to have genetic testing based on their individual scenario. So I thought I'd walk you through a few examples just with some of these different conditions, and we'll kind of get through as much as we can get through here. I want to leave plenty of time for questions in case you have them. So starting with the genetic arrhythmias, Dr. Nussbaum kind of illustrated the commonalities of these genetic arrhythmias as being structurally normal hearts, but there's an abnormality of the heart's electrical system. The symptoms of these include fainting or something we call syncope, irregular heart rate or palpitations, and sometimes these arrhythmias can be life-threatening, so we can see sudden death in these individuals. There are many different types of genetic arrhythmias, but the symptoms are really quite similar for all of them. The differences include the triggers, and this is where we not only ask about symptoms, we ask about the context of the symptoms. Did you have these while you were exercising? Did you have these while you were at rest? Were they provoked by an auditory stimulus or being having an emotional reaction, etc.? Diagnosis is all of the standard electrophysiology tests that we have, and the treatment varies depending on the severity. So the most common genetic arrhythmia syndrome that we see is something called long QT syndrome. And the QT interval is just a part of the normal heart function. It's on the electrical activity of the heart from when the lower chambers of the heart actually contract to when they relax. And there's a normal range of the QT interval that we know from looking at lots and lots of EKGs and people in the general population. And then we compare it to people who have this condition, and what do you know? It's longer. We're not that creative in genetics sometimes. Everything's either named after the person who found it or something very obvious. So people with long QT syndrome have a prolonged QT interval. Why does that make a difference? Well, if the QT interval is prolonged, it kind of means that the lower chambers of the heart aren't ready for the signal from the upper chambers of the heart, and that can lead to a dysynchronous beat, and that can lead to arrhythmias. So we see people who have the same symptoms. We often see people who are misdiagnosed, especially if they were having these symptoms in childhood. It's really common that they say, well, gosh, you know, they told me I had a seizure disorder and I never responded to the seizure medicine. I still kept having symptoms. Turns out they have long QT syndrome. Sometimes people are told they're just anxious and really they're having palpitations because of arrhythmias. This is an extremely variable condition. There are people who have the severest forms that can be associated with sudden death in childhood, and there are people who are completely asymptomatic with normal QT intervals on their EKG. And in the same family with the same mutation, you can see those vast differing phenotypes. The other thing that happens that makes this a challenging diagnosis is that the symptoms are intermittent. Sometimes patients will have an event in childhood or a couple events. They'll have a fainting episode that they don't even think much of and never have a problem the rest of their life. Sometimes people have, you know, 20 EKGs that show a normal QT interval followed by one that shows a prolonged QT. So it comes and goes, and it makes it a really hard diagnosis to make, which is why genetics can be so powerful, particularly if a mutation is found in this family, in a family. And I'll show you an example of why. Treatment is highly dependent on symptoms. So many people with long QT syndrome are very low risk. They may be entirely asymptomatic. They may have a QT interval that's normal or just mildly prolonged. Those people typically we think are at low risk. Even in those situations, if the patient is in the higher risk time in their life, like childhood for most, we typically put them on beta blockers because we know that they work really well at mitigating the risk for arrhythmias. So we may treat with medication even in the absence of symptoms. We typically won't use more aggressive therapies like an implantable defibrillator in those situations because we do think that they're low risk. But if we have a patient who's having symptoms despite being on an appropriate medical regimen, then we may consider putting in a defibrillator. These are devices that will sense if there's an abnormal rhythm and, if needed, deliver a therapy or a shock. Electrical shock doesn't sound much like a positive therapy, but in this situation, it's useful. So these are proven to prevent sudden cardiac death in individuals. We also counsel them to avoid triggers. So depending on which gene is involved with long QT syndrome, the triggers can differ. Patients with type 1 long QT are triggered by exercise. So we typically say, you know, if symptomatic, avoid competitive strenuous exercise because we know that that would be a higher risk time for them. Other types of long QT are really triggered by loud noises like ambulances going by or phones or alarms or things like this. Some of these are much more difficult to modify, but we do discuss that, and they do their best to do that. Many, many, many medications that are used for a variety of things in medicine, actually, one of the side effects is it prolongs prolongs the QT interval. For most people, it doesn't prolong it enough to cause any problems, any arrhythmias, but for these patients, it really does. And there's many patients that are perfectly fine until you give them a QT prolonging medication, and then they actually can develop serious heart rhythms. So we advise them to refrain from taking any of these QT prolonging drugs unless absolutely necessary. So I'll just go through a family history with you. And so this is the more traditional circles and squares. And you see your proband up here. This is a 67-year-old woman who came in because she had a long QT interval and had a history of fainting. She also had a significant family history. So her dad up here died suddenly at age 54. They didn't know the reason. And her mom lived a long, healthy life. She had three daughters. Her oldest daughter, who was an actually talented competitive swimmer, drowned at age 18. And as Dr. Nussbaum alluded to, this is a suspicious case. You have somebody who should have known how to swim, who was prepared and knew what to do, that all of a sudden drowned. That's a little unusual. Our patient never really believed that her daughter drowned. She always thought there was something more to it, but was never able to prove it. She had two other daughters, one who's perfectly healthy, and another one who was actually diagnosed with long QT syndrome after her two kids here started developing symptoms in childhood. And so what you see here is that the red little box, this is the long QT, a diagnosis of the long QT syndrome. So you're seeing the autosomal dominant transmission, 50-50 risk to pass it on. It affects genders equally. And that's a diagnosis that was made in her sister and her sister's son as well. We see a general history, a sudden cardiac death that could or could not potentially be associated with long QT, but is certainly somewhat suggestive. And then you see the genetic test results here. So this is our little genetic speak for the actual mutation that was found in the family. And everybody who is colored with the blue has a copy of that mutation. So this tells us that this, while we know clinically it's long QT syndrome, it tells us this is long QT syndrome type 1, which is typically triggered by exercise and particularly swimming. So a drowning in this context is highly, highly suspicious. This information also allows us to offer predictive testing to the family members who have not been evaluated or have no symptoms, including this woman, her son here, age 32, has six kids. He didn't have any clear symptoms, has not been evaluated, actually had genetic testing and does not carry this mutation. So he is not at risk and cannot pass the mutation to his six children. So there we had the benefit of being able to tell these four, seven people reassuring information that they're not at increased risk to have the same fate potentially as their descendant or whatever the word. So that's the power of genetic testing with regard to genetic arrhythmias. And it's the same principle for some of these other more rare genetic arrhythmias. The symptoms are very, very similar. The genes are different, but they can overlap. The concepts of genetic testing are all very, very similar. Moving on to just an example with the cardiomyopathies. So these are the heart muscle abnormalities, and there's a variety of cardiomyopathies. The heart can be too thick, hypertrophy. It can be too big and not work properly, and that would be dilatation or dilated cardiomyopathy. It can also be too stiff, where it's actually more of a restrictive phenotype, where the heart is just not able to relax or contract all that well. This leads to a variety of symptoms, typically shortness of breath and dizziness, sometimes fainting, especially with exertion. You can also increase the risk for abnormal heart rhythm. So you can get electrical problems that happen because of the remodeling of the heart, because the heart gets really stretched out, the electrical current doesn't go through as well, but also the underlying genetic abnormality predisposes to some electrical problems in patients as well. So because of that, patients can develop fainting or syncope, and they can even die suddenly from arrhythmias. This is a pedigree of an HCM family. So the proband is here, a 31-year-old woman. Her mother has HCM, was diagnosed at 45, a maternal uncle in his 30s, We don't have a real specific history in either parent, but are concerned that it could have been their mother, given the enlarged heart and heart failure, which can happen with people with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, again, thick heart muscle disease. And then there's some people in other generations where this individual doesn't appear to have HCM, but she has a daughter who has symptoms of it. So you can see different people in the family being more severely diagnosed than others, diagnosed at an earlier age than others, and some people who don't seem to have any problems, yet their children can have problems. That's variable expression, if you will. Another more form of cardiomyopathy that can really either be inherited or somewhat acquired is a dilated cardiomyopathy. We don't have a good understanding of how common this is. With hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, it affects about 1 in 500 people in the general population, which if you think about it is really pretty common. Dilated cardiomyopathy, it's unclear. It may affect just as many. We know that many forms of dilated cardiomyopathy are secondary to other heart problems or exposures. So people who have heart failure is kind of the end point of dilated cardiomyopathy in many situations. And oftentimes that happens because of blockages in arteries or coronary artery disease. Some viruses cause myocarditis, which can cause dilated cardiomyopathy. And then also toxins, as Dr. Nussbaum mentioned, excess alcohol, but also chemotherapies and different things like this. If we don't know what caused it, if none of these factors caused that or were present when someone was diagnosed with dilated cardiomyopathy, then it's called primary dilated cardiomyopathy or idiopathic. And that's, I love that term because it means we just don't understand it. Of these, a significant number are genetic, and we're learning more and more and more are genetic. At this point, maybe up to 30 to 40% of these cases are actually familial. Treatment for dilated cardiomyopathy depends on the stage at which it's diagnosed. If it's diagnosed in heart failure, medication is often very successful in being able to stabilize patients. Sometimes not, and sometimes patients are diagnosed too late, or they do not respond to heart failure medications and they do need transplantation or different assist devices that are becoming more and more sophisticated to delay transplantation. So if the function of the heart is very poor and or there are is a history of arrhythmias, then ICDs may be used to prevent sudden cardiac death. There are lots of genes that can cause dilated cardiomyopathy. Most of them follow this dominant pattern of inheritance with variable expression and something we called incomplete penetrance. What that basically means is you can have the genetic mutation and have never develop any signs or symptoms of the condition, but still transmit the mutation to an offspring who may be at very high risk and could develop severe disease. Our knowledge of the underlying genetics of dilated cardiomyopathy are somewhat limited, but developing quickly, we can actually find a mutation that causes it in maybe up to about 40% of familial cases at this point. So it is actually improving. Dr. Nussbaum kind of went over aortic aneurysms and dissections. These are very scary conditions because in the state of an aneurysm where it's just enlarged, it's really asymptomatic. People don't know that they have them. So diagnosing this in one family member is an incredible opportunity to try to identify it in other family members at a state that we can still treat it. Once a dissection occurs, then it's a life-threatening event. The symptoms of a dissection tend to be severe and persistent pain. It can be in the chest, the jaw, the neck, back, abdomen, depends many different places, but it's acute and it stays. At that point, it's emergent and patients need to be evaluated immediately and diagnosed correctly immediately, and a surgery is still high risk in those situations. There are both familial and sporadic forms of this. The genetic forms are ones that the genetic forms are more likely if the aneurysm is located in the chest or called a thoracic aorta, and especially in the absence of other risk factors, which we know can increase the risk for thoracic aortic aneurysms. They can be a part of a genetic syndrome. Dr. Nussbaum alluded to a syndrome called Marfan syndrome. This is a syndrome people may have heard of. There have been some professional athletes that have had this syndrome. It's associated with very tall stature, very long limbs. You can have problems with these having dilated aortas and aortas that tend to rupture with this condition. You can also have problems with vision with this condition. There are some other types of syndromic diseases or genetic syndromes that can cause aortic enlargement as well as enlargement of other vessels, not just the aorta. A more common form, or a very likely more common form of this, are the non-syndromic aortic aneurysm conditions. So there's one called TAAD, which is thoracic aortic aneurysm and dissection syndrome. This is isolated. People have no other problem, but they have a family history or a family predisposition to developing enlargement of the aorta. They follow a dominant inheritance pattern. Often, if left untreated, they will progress to dissection, but not always. So these tend to be extremely variable, and not everybody else and everybody in the family will be affected. Here's an example of what this looks like in a pedigree. So you see this individual who is the proband with the arrow, and she presented with an isolated aortic dissection at age 36. So just had an aortic dissection and survived it, thankfully. Genetic testing was done and a mutation was found. So what we found after evaluation is, both with genetic testing as well as with cardiac testing, because they really do go hand in hand. So we see that her brother has aortic enlargement, and a maternal aunt has aortic enlargement, and then a sister and a mother who have the mutation, but their aortic dimensions are perfectly normal. So we don't know if this mother will develop aortic enlargement over time, or if she'll be kind of a non-penetrant carrier, where maybe her aorta will always stay the same, but she has the mutation and has passed it to a daughter that has dissected. So you can see that degree of variability with this condition, which makes it very scary, but very important to know about. The good thing with these is that indeed these are treatable conditions. Both when it's in a state of dilatation, we have the ability to intervene with medication. And then if it actually gets to be a size where we're concerned for rupture, a planned surgery is much, much more successful than an emergent surgery. I'm going to wrap up pretty quick with a couple other themes and then leave some time for questions if that works for everybody. One thing I want to stress is that family history is very, very important, and it's very difficult to elicit cardiac family history. I'm sure everybody in the room has some degree of family history of something in their, you know, somebody's got a heart thing, a heart disease, somebody died suddenly of a heart attack, whatever that might mean. And so just so you know, this is a very well known that this is a difficult history to report. These are some of the symptoms that we tend to be asking about, and then we ask patients to go ahead and follow up as much as they possibly can with records and whatnot. There are some clues that we can get from all these legacy terms that get thrown around in a family, like they had a big heart or an old man's heart, but oftentimes we really need medical records or some kind of documentation in order to evaluate. Another thing to know is that people tend to say family history is negative, and this is true in cardiology as well as other cases too, but just because a person hasn't been evaluated doesn't mean they have a negative family history. Many, many, many times the first presentation when I'm talking with a family, there's no family history, but once I recommend that immediate family members seek cardiac evaluation, new diagnoses are made. So this is an evolving situation. A few just interesting counseling issues, because I think they're kind of fun and get people thinking about this on a personal level. I'll just skip this. This is just saying this is standard of care. Really, what does this mean for families? So for at-risk relatives, so if you have no history, you're very healthy, and now all of a sudden a family member who may have survived a cardiac arrest is found to have a gene mutation, and they say, hey, you have a 50% chance of having this gene mutation, and that could mean that you could have a cardiac arrest as well. Obviously, that's something that's a just extremely challenging thing for people to get their mind around. And at what point is this something that is recommended to the patient? Is this something that they should know about because these are treatable conditions? Should they know about it because then they know if their children would be at risk as well? And believe it or not, and I think it's very understandable, is that most people in this setting are actually in a state of kind of pushing this information, very adverse to this information, because it's just kind of too scary to deal with. So we get a lot of situations where a patient has notified their relatives and gets kind of a denial reaction from family members. They say, oh no, that's your problem. I feel fine. This doesn't affect me. And so it brings up a lot of different kind of reactions. Some people really get very, very scared and nervous and feel like at any point they could develop symptoms and at any point they could die suddenly. But I think, you know, in general, this is something that the reaction really evolves over time and it's very dynamic as different family members are evaluated. Another thing that becomes very challenging is that both treatment and medical treatment impacts lifestyle, but also these modifications that we often recommend for the management of individuals. So particularly around athletics and competitive athletics, some of these conditions will obviously predispose to arrhythmias during exercise. And so it's not advisable for these individuals to participate in competitive athletics. Now, if for somebody who is older, and they have their career and things, and it's not in a professional sport, this might not be the end of the world. But often these are things that can be diagnosed in adolescence. And it's one thing to be denying a patient, you know, their, you know, kind of pickup soccer game in their older years or middle age years, but it's a different thing to have to take a kid out of competitive soccer when that's his whole peer group and identity and friends and all those types of things. So it can have some impact and stigma in this area as well. And then I'm just going to skip through this. So the other thing that comes up are some ethical issues. And so these tend to be, what do you do when somebody has one of these genetic arrhythmias or cardiomyopathies or vascular disease and is known to be at increased risk of sudden cardiac death? We feel like we're treating the sudden cardiac death risk, but we can never fully prevent it. And now we know about it. So what do we do if they're potentially, this person works in a public safety capacity? They are a bus driver or they're a pilot or something like this. You know, there's a lot of ethical questions that can come up around this. And to be honest, we don't necessarily have all the answers when it comes to these things. Also, things that come up are for us as genetics professionals is the patient has all this information, and this information that in some ways affects their own health, but almost more impactfully affects the health of or potential risk for their family members. What happens if that patient is no longer talking with their sibling because of some type of feud? You know, they don't want to share that information that could be beneficial to that sibling's children. How far do we go to be able to try to convince them that that's the right thing to do? What kind of tools do we give them? There's a lot of communication and thought that goes into the duty to warn the at-risk family members that are really, you know, we have no contact with, but they're not our direct patients. So it's something that we struggle with, and we're trying the best that we can. So just to sum up some take-home messages, and then I think we'll be ready for questions. So there are many, many, many different types of cardiovascular disease. This is true for both the genetics and non-genetics. So, you know, these conditions are collectively somewhat common, but far more common are your kind of routine general population cardiovascular diseases. And those are just as important for people to know about because they're present in every one of our family histories. We should know if our relatives had died suddenly because they had blocked arteries, or they may have had an arrhythmia, or if there's anything suspicious in their history, because it helps us inform our own and our children. Generally speaking, these are inherited in a dominant pattern, so there's a 50-50 chance that anybody who has the condition will pass it to each of their children. Generally speaking, they're extremely variable with a wide range of age of onset, severity, etc. Genetic testing is common. complicated. We would love if genetic testing was black and white, a binary thing, like you have an elevated cholesterol or you don't. It is extremely complex and there's a lot of gray area. Using genetics in preventative cardiology requires absolutely both. It requires as much cardiology, more cardiology in some ways than genetics, and it is a very dynamic and a moving target. So I thank you for your attention, and we both, Dr. Nussbaum and I, would welcome questions at this point. Okay, over. Blue in the back.
Johnny, your 18-year-old swimmer. Any comment about the future of testing competitive high school students in general? It must be pretty expensive.
Need the question
for everybody.
Yeah. So the question is about what is the future outlook on potentially testing athletes, high school athletes, for these types of conditions. That is a very controversial issue on so many levels, which is surprising in some ways. So different people take different approaches, different countries take different approaches. In the U.S., there's no formalized kind of screening program for high school athletes. They go through their sports physical and whatnot, but that generally does not include an EKG or anything more advanced for that matter. In San Francisco, we have kind of a voluntary initiative through UCSF where we offer sports physicals to all high school athletes. They're voluntary. They're on a Saturday, and it involves not only cardiology but orthopedics. And that's something called PlaySafe that's been done for a number of years here in San Francisco. Different communities have similar types of programs with the idea that if you screen young athletes, then you'd be able to pick something like this up and prevent sudden death. It's controversial for a lot of reasons. One reason is the symptoms are not, these conditions are not only, they don't only affect athletes. And there are people who have these conditions, children and adults, who develop symptoms outside of exercise. So the question is, are we selectively only giving preferential treatment to athletes versus others in the general population? And then you have the issues of costs and liability. And it's a fascinating topic. I won't go on and berate it too much. Have it down here.
The public opinion polls show that Americans, over half of Americans, don't believe in evolution. You have presidential candidates saying it doesn't exist. I mean, that kind of nonsense.
I think that's a question for you.
Do you find in your patients that it's either getting better or worse in understanding some of these things? I would think in your line of work, it would be maddening at some point.
Yeah, that's a fascinating opinion. Oh, so the question, I think you could summarize it to say, well, if in the general population there's a fair percentage that doesn't necessarily believe in evolution, if you will, is it challenging to be able to kind of explain genetics to patients if they may be coming from that background? You're right. You know, there's a significant number of people in the U.S. that doesn't kind of believe in kind of genetics and science. I've really never run into problems with that in 20 years, 15 years.
I haven't either. I think it's because you can talk about inheritance in a family. Everybody's aware. You know, the things run in families, and I look like my father, and my father looked like his mother. So I think that's something people are very comfortable with, whether or not they believe in Darwin. So I think there's a clear separation between inheritance and evolution.
Yeah, are there any external factors such as toxins or radiation or whatever that can change the DNA and you can pass it on to the next generation?
Let me grab this one. You can grab it either way.
Okay, either way, the question is whether there are external toxins, radiation, et cetera, which change the DNA and can affect what happens in the next generation. So probably the place where that has been looked at most closely is in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where we have extremely detailed measurements of radiation exposure. There were a number of geneticists. There's a famous geneticist called James Neal from University of Michigan who spent many years in Japan studying the after effects of the explosion, the atomic bombs. And what we can tell is that the effect is actually quite limited on inherited genetic disease. The effect is much greater in acquired cancers, in particular thyroid cancer and other forms of cancer. The vast majority of genetic mutations occur because of errors in the way cells duplicate and make their DNA. And the external toxins and effects probably add a little bit, but at a very low level.
All of a sudden tomorrow, well, yesterday rather, I had a heart attack. Should my children now be tested? Is that, you know, just, as soon as somebody has something, mm-hmm. then the rest of the family should get tested. Is that correct?
The answer would be it depends. Oh, the question. Thank you. The question would be: so, if someone has a sudden death, a heart attack, does that automatically mean that the family members should be evaluated? The answer I would say is it depends on a lot of different factors. So some causes of sudden death are not cardiac at all. Dr. Nussbaum alluded to an initiative that's going on here at UCSF to try to better understand and categorize the causes of sudden death. And many of them are completely unrelated to the heart or the vascular system.
I didn't die.
So if that's
and we
certainly can talk about individual family histories after too. We'll be staying around for a while, but that's a good point. So if it's a sudden death that is due or an aborted sudden death, if you will, that was due to a known condition like a dissection, like an arrhythmia that it was then documented repeatedly that they had, or a cardiomyopathy, then yes, the family members would be evaluated. If it was something that was a sudden death that happened in somebody and looks like it was a non-genetic cause from the associated information, then potentially family members wouldn't be at higher risk. So it really depends on a lot of factors: age, cause, circumstances, exposures, etc.
I have two questions about the current bioinformatics technology. First, when people are coming together to be married, they share all kinds of disclosure. They have all kinds of personal information, especially if they're going to contemplate pregnancy. Do people now have the ability to share genetic information so they can decide whether they really want to do that? And the second question I have is, about a month ago in Washington, D.C., there was a terrible crime, and the police say they were able to identify the suspect. By DNA, they harvested off a pizza crust. And it seemed to me kind of preposterous that they could do that. First, that they could harvest that, and second, where this information would be stored. But are we really at that level where the state has that much information about people?
I'll let you take this one.
So two questions was how much genetic information is obtained when a couple is contemplating a pregnancy, and what's available, as well as what's preferable for that couple to decide to do. And the second question has to do with the use of DNA, essentially DNA fingerprinting, for crime solving, and is that information being stored and being used by the government? So I'll talk about the first one first. We already have the ability to test for dozens, if not hundreds, of different genetic disorders that a child might be at risk for because the child inherits two abnormal genes, one from each parent, that are silent genes, but are called recessive. So the parents carry one normal copy, one defective copy, but in this case, the normal copy compensates for the defective one. So the parents are silent carriers, but then there's one chance in four that the child could inherit two abnormal, one half from one parent, one half from the other, one chance in four. There are certain groups, for example, among Orthodox Jews in New York, there where many of the marriages are arranged marriages. They have a whole system in place now where individuals who are contemplating an arranged marriage can have themselves tested for up to 10 different disorders that are common among Ashkenazi Jews, things like Tay-Sachs disease, Canavan disease, etc. That information is then given to a third party, and the names are not given, but this third party, who's usually a rabbi, is told, individual A, individual B are contemplating getting married. This is what their genetic information is. And then the rabbi would either come back and say, fine, or consider a different arrangement. So that actually is going on now in that setting. Pretty rare. In this, you know, outside of those particular groups, it's voluntary, but many people now contemplating a pregnancy would have up to 100 different genetic genes tested. Among Caucasians of European descent, cystic fibrosis is way at the top of what people are tested for being carriers. The second question is absolutely fascinating. I don't think people are aware of this, but there are literally tens of millions of DNA fingerprints that are in the hands of the government. Many of them come from individuals who have actually never been convicted of a crime. They're obtained from suspects who may actually have been exonerated. They still have the right to keep that information. This was challenged twice now, once in the Maryland state court and once in a federal court in California. The ACLU brought two lawsuits over this. And I happen to know that because I served as an amicus of the court in both those cases. And in both cases, the judges said, this information is important for solving cold crimes. There are laws against the misuse of the information by the police. I mean, you can judge for yourself how well those laws would apply, but that's what the judge said. And that this is no different an identifier than a fingerprint, and therefore it's perfectly legal to keep it. The banks of this information is just growing by leaps and bounds, and so I would anticipate that within the next 20 years, every American will have a DNA fingerprint on file. You can argue that that there's been benefit of it. In fact, some people will argue that of all the impact across society of the revolution in genetics, the impact on the forensic area of the law has been greater than it's been in medicine. For example, 20 years ago, our courts were full of paternity suits. Tons of them. They're gone. There's no paternity suit now. The DNA fingerprint tells you, yes, that was the father, and no, it wasn't. And that's the end of that.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.